All right, hello everyone. Long time no see. Actually, Scott, I was just with them 5 minutes ago, so it hasn't been long at all. But here I am now with Scott Killaby. And Scott, would you just like to say hi out loud so they can hear you?
Hi everybody. I'd love to hear from some of you, so it doesn't look like it's just me and Regina talking here, but that would be fine too if it's just me and her.
Yeah. I always love it when they interact. And another thing they do sometimes is they just type questions on. I can see questions that they type too, so sometimes I can share that with you. But we do love it. If you all want to get involved, you know how to do it. Just put your hand up and I'll turn the mic over to you. And you can talk to Scott. Right now we do have people typing in the room, hi Scott, so they're already interacting in their own way. But Scott, I'm not going to assume that everyone knows who you are. I think that probably some of them do. Some of them might even know who you are quite well, but there may be others in the sanctuary who don't know you at all. So I think we should start with the brief kind of who is Scott Killaby and what does he do story.
Okay. Well, you know, there's the short version and there's the long version.
Yeah.
Let me keep to the short version. Well, what I do right now is that I'm the director of the Killaby Center for Recovery, which is a center for the treatment of addiction, depression, and anxiety using presence-based practices and the living inquiries, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Before that and continuing on, I guess you could say that I'm a spiritual teacher, although I never really wore that totally comfortably. It's just that things happened to me, experiences and shifts happened to me, and I started to blog about it, and people would invite me, just like you've done here very graciously, to come talk about it. And so I'm in contact with people like that are kind of on the spiritual search too. So I do a little bit of both, kind of the spiritual teaching side and then the treatment side, mostly the treatment side these days. And I've written about 6 books. They're all on Amazon. Just Google or Amazon search results for Scott Killaby. You'll see those books. And the book the Killaby Center is based on is called Natural Rest for Addiction. That's really the only book that kind of is specialized in that way. It's about addiction.
Okay, good. Well, tell you what, why don't we start with the spiritual story a little bit? Why don't you tell us what was happening with you when you started having these shifts? How did all of this come about?
You know, I think it's worthy to note that one of the things that I had done is I had stopped using drugs and alcohol after 20 years. And I think that's important to recognize because the more that I work with people who are addicted to almost anything, the more that they can drop those things, the easier I think these practices and shifts can happen. And I didn't always believe that, but I've come to see that now. So I think that was the big part of it was to drop the drugs and alcohol and a lot of the other addictions. And then I began to explore my experience. I went through many different kinds of practices, positive thinking strategies, The Secret, you know, reading about the saints and the various traditions and what they had, the masters, and finding a lot of really good stuff. What finally resonated with me was the message that that I'm not who I think I am, and the non-dual presence that can be recognized when you really see that who you thought you were is not what you are, and just the basic message that there's the capacity to live here, awake and aware in the moment rather than identifying with all the stuff that comes and goes. And that's the non-dual message. So when I started to do those practices, I'm the kind of person that if I do something, kind of the way that I did drugs and alcohol, if I'm going to get into something, I'm going to do it 110%. And I did, and I made it all about practice and experiential work and kind of weaving that into my daily life. The shifts that I had, there were several experiences. One of the first ones was after doing these kinds of practices, feeling this really tightly bound ball of energy in my chest. And it was actually painful for a while. It stayed there for about 2 weeks. And it also became euphoric. And I was just sitting watching a TV show. I can tell you what TV show was about, but I'm not sure how relevant it is. But then that energy just melted away, and my mind went completely still, and my jaw dropped open. And the reason my jaw was dropping open is because I was in complete awe of the fact that there was even stillness here, because I had not known that before that. It was a very, very deep and palpable stillness. And that sort of shifted things so that a lot of my thinking sort of reprocessed itself. out of that. You know, I started to see that a lot of the divisions in my mind that I had thought were true and real just were not. But the seeking just kept going in just a little bit. It was more like a snail at that point. Then I was lying in bed one night with my doggies, although this one wasn't there, it wasn't born yet. And I was petting my two dogs, and I instantly felt that I was not separate from what they were. I felt no sense of separation. And it's almost like fireworks started going off all over my body and mind. Almost, it's kind of like the light switched on inside my body and mind. And that's like, it's just a metaphor. And then I walked around my apartment, utterly and totally amazed at the fact that whatever I am, it has no sense of separation from anything else. Like, literally, like the street light out the window, the bathroom, the floor. I mean, I was doing silly things like on the floor, grabbing the carpet, like laughing, and then looking at time as the little digital clock would go and laughing at the whole idea that we believe time is real, and then having insight that we believe that death is real and death isn't really real. And then an enormous amount of love came over me, and that stayed. And the love, I used to say, kind of just devoured me. I mean, it just devoured a lot of me. And then there were other insights that happened later. It wasn't just one shift for me. It's been as much gradual as it has been sudden for me. But those initial experiences just automatically resulted in me sharing about that without even seeing myself as a teacher. I just started sharing about it. And then slowly, the stuff got kind of built up.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Now, how did the shift come about where you got into, like you said, one of your books is more about the addiction and the healing from addiction. How did this shift occur where you started moving into that?
I always knew that I wanted to write and talk about addiction, but I wanted to wait until I had the right words. So I felt like if I started talking about it too early, I wouldn't give the subject the right treatment that it needed. So I spent many years just sitting on it and knowing that there's something was brewing. And then it just came out. I started writing about it several years later, and the book came out in a very short time span. I'm really just sort of speaking to the same insights that I've had through the years about where the nature of addiction comes from and how does it fall away. It just came out that way. It really wasn't so much calculated. It was just waiting for the right time for it to come out. And it's still coming out and developing, you know, obviously with the center.
Yeah, and how did you get to have the Killaby Center? How did that come about?
I was lucky enough to be involved with some good people that were helping to bring the message about addiction to a larger audience. One fellow in particular set up some talks across the country. And we were having these talks, and then, you know, it just so happened that there were investors at those talks. And I had already thought about having a center, but from the good graces of those people offering to help to do that and making that happen, the center eventually opened and still there.
Yeah, well, that's what I call, you know, the grace of God, the gifts of God, the way it unfolds when, like it's supposed to, all of that. Well, what happens at the center?
So the center is really what we've done is we've kind of redeveloped treatment through our own method. I mean, of course, we take from other centers in terms of the clinical or the administrative part, but the experiential or the real transformative work comes from these insights, these non-dual insights and the inquiries that we've developed. So it's like a treatment center in the sense that you come for a specific issue like depression, trauma, addiction, anxiety. And the addiction part of that, the recovery part of that includes, you know, abstinence and drug testing and all the stuff that you would see at a center. But the work is very different than other places because it involves this inquiry, which you don't see pretty much in any, or I wouldn't imagine many of the treatment centers have that kind of work. So that's kind of why it's unique is that we're really developing something.
And is there, go ahead.
Well, we're developing something that's been around for thousands of years, I was going to say.
Yeah.
We're applying it specifically to these things, yeah.
And was there any talk in the center about awakening to the true self, or is it purely focused on, you know, their reason for coming?
It starts off focused on the reason for coming. We tend not to kind of like go straight to the awakening early because there are other practical things that need to be taken care of, like getting through with the withdrawal period or dealing with the trauma from childhood or just learning how to live without drugs and alcohol first. But then inevitably for most people, if they stay long enough, the awakening thing starts to become important, although not for everybody because not everybody's at a place where they're ready for that. So we kind of wait to see what the right time is and if they're ready for that, and then we introduce those kind of things.
All right. All right. So I have you mentioned something earlier that I would like to go back and ask about. You when I started asking you about the spiritual part of your story, the shifts, you said something that was important was that you got off of the drugs and alcohol, and then you made a little comment that you used to not think that was important. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. So, I mean, I think I always knew that it was important to get off the drugs and alcohol in order to really look at these issues, but addiction to me is much broader than that. It's also addiction to tobacco, caffeine, sex, shopping, gambling, spiritual seeking, self-improvement. And I think that it's just about focus. So if your focus is on gambling, if your focus is on having 3 cups of coffee a day, if your focus is on getting sugar to cover up feelings, then your focus is not going to be on these practices as much. And your system's going to be affected by the up and down of the withdrawal craving cycle of that. And so by getting that out of your system, you're able to focus more on some of these practices and to deal with the underlying stuff that has been pushed down as a result of those addictions. So the more you can kind of eliminate, this is just my feeling, the more you can eliminate, I think the deeper you can go faster with it.
Yeah, and I think that all of us come to that realization at some point. I'm not sure everybody is there now, not even everybody that is listening. One of the classes that I teach is a Buddhist class based on Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, and he talks about habit energies and overcoming habit energies, and not everybody even likes to hear that, you know. But I think you're right. I think we all come to that realization at some point.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point because not everybody is ready to hear that. And when I would do the kind of the standard spiritual awakening type retreat, I did notice that not everybody was interested in hearing that, and I think that's totally okay because everybody should be where they're at. But I wanted to talk about it, so having a treatment center was perfect because so I got to talk about it to an audience of people who were interested in it, you know. But not everybody is ready for that or not completely ready, and I've not always been completely ready either.
Right, me neither. I agree. Well, let's assume that the reason they showed, because I told them that we were going to, I mean, I gave some heads up, this is what we were going to talk about. So let's assume that the people that are here, whether they're ready or not, they're willing to listen. How's that sound?
Okay.
Maybe there's some people in the room who have drug or alcohol addictions. Probably more commonly, we're going to find addictions like food. You know, food is such a common addiction. Too much television. What other common addictions are there that people don't even think of as addictions?
Work. Yeah. Self-improvement is a big one. With the spiritual seeking itself, you can think of it in part as having an addictive quality, like where you're constantly trying to have it the next experience or the next state. People don't always think of it that way. Work is definitely one that people, but caffeine, I mean, just someone who drinks like 4 or 5 glasses of tea every day would not necessarily think of that as a major issue, and maybe it's not, but it can be in the sense that if you can't let go of it, you know, so it could be that. There are all sorts of addictions, too many to name. I mean, there are people who are addicted to eating rubber. There are people for real, there are not a lot of them, but...
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that one.
Eating rubber or smelling mothballs or just about anything. Those are more extreme views, but just to show you that, you know, addiction really is definitely not just about drugs and alcohol.
Okay, so again, we may have people in the room who are addicted to drugs and alcohol. That's absolutely possible. But my guess is that most of them have more of these, what I'm going to call socially accepted addictions. Probably food is extremely common. Too much TV is extremely common. Maybe work is extremely common. So convince me, all right? in whatever way that you can, that if what I really want is awakening, that maybe my addiction, food, TV, work is in my way.
Right. Well, because it's where your focus is. So with these particular practices that involve resting as, or recognizing presence as the foundation of your experience, recognizing this capacity to be aware of experience, when we're often focused very narrowly on addiction, that's where our entire focus is. So we might be tuned out of the body watching TV for 3 hours. We don't even know how we feel, or we're, maybe there's an issue that needs to kind of be felt and dealt with from a conversation with a spouse earlier, but we've just numbed out and now we're focused on TV. Or even, you know, there's many times when I've worked with people who, you know, they come into a session and they've told me before the session that they've got a lot of things that they really need to examine. They come to the session and they're like, you know what? I'm feeling pretty good right now. And then I'll say, well, did you just go to Starbucks? Right?
Yeah.
They'll say, yeah. I'll say, well, that's probably what it is. It medicated or numbed out what you... So when you talk about a practice that is really about, in a very raw way, meeting everything as it arises, and maybe not everything all at once, right? But learning to meet everything as it arises, anything that tunes you out and tunes you away from your experience to focus very narrowly on something outside yourself can be, shall we say, getting in the way or making it more challenging for you.
Yeah, at the very least, a delay tactic, right?
Delay tactic, but we all do that too. That's the other thing, is we can create an atmosphere where there's no judgment around that, and we can just say we all do that in varying degrees, and then until we start to see that that's what we're doing, and we become open or ready to take a look at it, really. Because I've done it too. I've there have been times in my life when I've been glued to a TV for 2 or 3 hours a night, you know, and
watching nothing. But, yeah.
Yeah, watching nothing, but also, but I think the key is not just that you're doing something like that, but that you're doing it as a way to avoid experience. That's the thing. If there's an avoidance strategy, it's, I think, part of the thing.
All right. So I want to talk more about your experience again, because you know your experience the best, so you can talk about it in a most alive way. You commented that when you did at some point get into the spiritual practice, that you did it 110%. Can you just describe what your days were like then?
Yeah. So I was practicing as an attorney back then. I was living above my law office. I had my law office below, and I was listening to teachings that were saying, you know, you can meditate in the morning and at night. And I would do that. But the problem is that the time that was sandwiched in between that was when life was really happening. So, you know, I could be really quiet and awake and aware in the morning and very present, and then, or do that at night. But then during the day, as an attorney, dealing with problems, dealing with people who are angry and upset at the worst time of their life, dealing with judges who don't have a paper in on the time, and they're, you know, all this stuff, is that I needed a way to bring those practices into my daily life. So what I learned to do is to become keenly aware of thoughts as they were arising. In the middle of conversations, becoming aware of the thought stream that I'm having. In the middle of talking on the phone, is coming down to meet a feeling that was arising and being very quiet with it while I'm listening. Or after I hang up the phone or into conversations, coming back to my experience and examining questions of identity that were coming up in the conversation. So it was really like, you know, where people will sometimes compartmentalize life. They'll say, well, this is my spiritual practice here, and this is my work or my regular life here. What I was trying to do was this, to bring them completely together. And that's what I think helped make the difference for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't we, do you think there's anything else that we need to share just to give people kind of the intro overview before we go into the living inquiries?
I don't think so. If something pops up, we'll talk about it.
Okay, good. Well, then why don't we tell them what the heck these living inquiries are?
Yeah, you know, I mean, my poor husband will hate that I'm referencing this again, but I often, I tell people that he's the reason that the great thing about partnerships like that is that, you know, the person is your best teacher, right?
Yes.
The person works as a trigger, it looks like. And so, after I had all these awakening experiences, you know, I think there was part of me that wanted to think that I had transcended all pain and suffering and stories of lack. But then what a husband is really good for is to bring that up for me. And And I do that for him, too.
May I ask two questions about him before we continue? How long have you been with him?
14 years.
And is he on a spiritual path?
Yes, he is very much on, and has his own experiences and does regular work and everything.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So in the course of what I had to do for myself was to find a way to really dig deeper into my experience about what was really getting triggered on a much deeper level. Like, and for me, it was a real core deficiency story that hadn't really worked itself out through the awakening. And for me, it was a sense of being unlovable or wrong. So that if you would look at me a certain way or say a certain thing to me that was judgeful, if that's a word, I would feel this sort of pain and this reactivity around it, but simply just resting with it wasn't enough for me because I could see that there was something that I believed about myself that was unconscious. So the inquiries were really, created those with the help of my teacher, Greg Good, but I created those as a way to penetrate through some of the deeper strands of my own suffering, and it was a way of kind of giving a name to the identity that was popping up in those relationships, and then having a way to see through the identity and to be with the core pain, and to really, like, in a very focused way, instead of just, people will say, well, just let it be, that wasn't enough, because the pattern just kept arising in a very sticky way. So the inquiries were born out of needing for myself to go deeper to look at who I was, so that was what was still coming up for me in relationship, really. And then from that, I trained about 8 people. They became trainers, and now we've got a whole facilitator program of the living inquiries that have really developed themselves, or they've been developed by me and by the facilitators for a number of years. That's part of what we use at the center is the living inquiries.
All right, so let me just check real quick. We do have a question. We have a friend named Igor. Igor is in Russia. He wants to know if you are familiar with A Course in Miracles.
Only on a surface level. I can't say that I have a lot of respect for what I know about it, and there are certain quotes. I know just enough to be dangerous, but I feel like that the Course in Miracles is definitely in alignment with this kind of work from what I've read, because I think it talks about the illusory nature of reality, and there's a few quotes I could probably butcher, but yeah, I'm vaguely aware, enough to know that it feels in pretty much in alignment with this kind of thing.
Yeah, A Course in Miracles is what Igor is primarily into right now, so let's see, I think there may have been another question here. He says, I have a question for Scott when he is ready. This is Jay that is asking. Jay's in Chicago. He says, what is addiction according to teaching? Like a 101 description. So the question is, what is addiction? Yes.
Yeah. Well, when I went through addiction specialist school, they gave me their definition of it. And it wasn't a bad definition. And frankly, I can't remember it exactly because it didn't totally resonate with me. But the way that I define it in the Natural Rest for Addiction book is repetitively ingesting or using something as a way to cover up and not feel or medicate something that you're feeling. So repetitively doing that as a way to cover up or medicate or get rid of something, but in a manner that has nothing to do with survival. So that's the key, because when you're thirsty for water, you're going to feel that in your body, and it's important for you to get water. So we don't call that an addiction, or the basic needs of life like food, shelter. But what I'm talking about is using other substances beyond our basic needs in a repetitive manner to try to suppress, avoid, get rid of feelings. So it's in the book I stated a much more concise way, but that's kind of how I define it. So we can define it really, really broadly. That it could be any substance or activity that we use to try to avoid having to feel what's happening.
All right. And I think I've caught all the questions at this point. Is that true? And don't forget, you all can put your hand up if you like. I'm sometimes looking at Scott and sometimes looking at you. So if you put your hand up, you may have to be patient. If you ask a question and it scrolls off the board, you may have to put it on again, because I'm not always looking at you. I'm looking at Scott, too. One person has written in all caps, and this is an addiction that many people are familiar with, chocolate, or for some people it would be potato chips or something similar. So let's start with something extremely common like that. Probably when I talk to people, more people tell me they feel food is their problem than anything else. So let's start with something that common. Can you tell us how we would use this at night? Okay, we've had our entire day. Everything went well even. You know, it was a good day, but at night there's just this habit of setting down, turning on the TV, and then eating again. And then eating again. And, you know, we're making ourselves miserable, but for some reason the eating isn't stopping. How can we use the inquiries with something like that?
So even before you get into inquiry, there's some non-inquiry things that you can do. And one of them is to, throughout the day, start tuning into your body in a very direct way. So that when you feel stress or anxiety or guilt or shame or anything, you come down into the feeling with awareness and just let it be there. Including any resistance that you have to it, any fighting against it, or any trying to pull away from it. Become aware not only of the feeling, but any way that you're fighting or trying to pull away from the feeling. Because if you set up that habit, what happens is that you start welcoming naturally all of the feelings that you would try to eat away at night. Right? So just that practice, bringing that during the day. It's just all throughout the day is learning to be more aware of the inner body, letting things be there. Peeling words and stories off of the feelings. So it's one of the first things we kind of learn to do in therapy is we name a feeling. We say, I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling afraid. But really, in order to go deeper, you kind of have to let the label fall away so that you can feel the direct energy of that in awareness without the word on it, mediating it. Learning how to do that will help a lot because you won't be storing so much negative emotions by the end of the day. You won't be storing so much stress. You will have felt it and let it release more often throughout the day. So doing that,
Repeat what you said, make sure I'm hearing it correctly, and also just emphasize it, because sometimes when people are listening, you know, they tune out, they come back, right? So if I heard you correctly, what you're saying is, even on what we might call a good day, there may have been a number of maybe small things, they didn't appear big, that we weren't feeling, that we were oppressing, that we were turning away from. And so at night, when we sit down to relax, in some way, those things are still there, maybe not in a conscious way, and that's a part of why we start eating. Now we're trying to make ourselves feel better, even if we weren't fully aware that we felt bad.
Yeah. That's one way that I think addictive eating shows up, as just a way to eat away feelings, because you get that pleasurable hit from it.
Yeah.
And for whatever you were feeling, even if you didn't know it before, certainly you're not feeling it after the chocolate. You're feeling the chocolate.
Right.
And so just tuning more into feelings during the day, but in a very, very direct way. So like you come down without a label for it. You're with it, and you're noticing in any way in which you're resisting it or turning away from it. Because that's what allows you to rest with it. That's what I call it, natural rest, resting with something, letting something be as it is. So that's one of the things. But, you know, I don't want to oversimplify, because sometimes overeating can sometimes be linked to trauma. I mean, the studies are coming out now saying that a lot of people who are doing addictive eating are doing that as a way to medicate unconscious trauma that happened to them when they were a kid. And I see it all the time at the center. That it's not just about the daily stresses. It's actually about something that happened when they were speaking.
Oh, that's okay. We'll see if my dog decides to join in.
Somebody walks by.
I understand. I have a dog.
Yeah. But it's not just about the daily stresses that you feel. It could be about something that happened to you when you were 10 years old. You were ridiculed. You were bullied. You felt rejected. You were molested. You were... And you didn't have the consciousness to deal with it back then. You didn't know how to process it. And so the stuff got stored in your body in PTSD or trauma-like way. And then because it's never truly been processed, every day eating is a way to keep stuffing it down, just like heroin would be a way to stuff it down. So I don't want to oversimplify and say it's always just about the daily stresses, because it's not. Sometimes it's much deeper than that.
All right.
So in that case, you want to deal with the trauma. You really don't want to overlook that. Also, you know, I'll get to the inquiries in a second, but if you can simply become aware of the aversion that you have towards food. So in other words, there's usually a craving for food, but there's also like a I should.
Yes.
I'm bad, or this is bad, or here I go again. if you can become aware of those feelings, as those thoughts as they come across and come down and feel those feelings. I mean, I've worked with people and we've put like a Hershey bar in the middle of the table and we've never dealt with the craving. All we did was work on the aversion. So all of the judgments, the self-judging thoughts that come through and feelings, and we just worked with those. And by the end of the session, the craving was at zero. Just because there's all kinds of stuff locked into a craving. It's not just a craving. There's judgment about it. There's sometimes more shame than you can imagine around food, around Diet Coke, around whatever. So you want to be aware that that's operating and be mindful of that. The inquiries, if you really want me to get into it, is a little more structured way of looking at it, and I can explain that, but you kind of have to learn that process.
I do, but tell you what, before we start, since that's going to be structured, I have a question. Let's take the question, and then we'll come back, because I do think that it's helpful for people to hear the inquiries the way I've heard you explain them before. It gives them an idea of what we're talking about. So actually, I have a couple of questions. Maybe three questions. They're really coming. So here's another one from Igor. let's see. He says, if Scott's experience was so great, he's referring, of course, to your shifts, how can we get there too, preferably permanently? Do you have an answer to that question?
I have a lot of answers to that question. The thing is if you want freedom bad enough, if you have whatever that is in you, And it's just something that you can't bottle up and you can't give it to anybody. We call it readiness. But if you have that in you already and your focus is that and it's not being taken away by other things, then you will have that freedom in your life. It's just inevitable that you will. I think most of what keeps people from that is that they want that, but they get sidetracked with a lot of other things. You know, because the new potential spouse comes into their life and they're focused on that. They've got a job on here and they're really trying to be successful and their focus is on that. And I think wherever your focus is, that's what you're going to get more of, you know. So if your focus is on these practices and on being with everything as it arises, watching thoughts come and go, questioning whether they are you or not, letting feelings be as they are, all of that, recognizing the awareness behind all that, it's almost inevitable if the focus is there that you will recognize. It's a matter of readiness, though, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I only know Igor a little, but he seems pretty sincere. So I think that he's probably off on a good start. If he sticks with that sincerity and stays with it, right?
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's look. Next we have Tony. Tony says, do you consider your treatment center to follow a spiritual path or having a higher power that is greater than the person?
Not particularly, because the higher power thing comes from both the Christian kind of based thinking, but also from the 12-step based thinking, and that predominates the recovery world. The 12 steps contain a higher power. Our particular approach does not incorporate that affirmatively, but it also doesn't deny it, so that if people want to bring that into the center, we encourage that if that's what helps them, because that's where they're at with it. But the particular methodology that we're using, it's not important to have, because if you look at the third step, turning it over to God, right? That's what they're saying, is turning it over. What does that mean, really? I mean, it's the same thing as awareness, is that in every moment you're seeing that.
Yeah, you know what my dog wants outside, so. You keep talking for a minute. When your dog stops, I'm just going to go right over there and open the door, because my dog is starting to cry and they might be responding to her a little bit. So,
we'll do that.
But go ahead and answer and I'll let her out.
Well, so what is turning you over is in the same way when you're resting as awareness, you're noticing thoughts and feelings come and go and they're being turned over constantly. I mean, they're coming and they're going. And that's really, in a way, what the third step is talking about when they're saying turning things over to God. Here you're just turning things over within awareness, like letting things come and go. So in essence, the same thing, same principle is operating as the third step, but we don't use the concept of higher power as being necessary for this work.
So did that feel weird when I walked away from you while you were talking?
I was just trying to talk to the wall there. The wall seemed to be interested, so I was...
Yeah, usually I open the door before I start doing something like this, but I forgot tonight, and she wasn't going to let go, so she doesn't know how to let go when she wants to go outside. All right, we have another question. Let's see, from Jacqueline. She says, how do you deal with the aversion? You were talking about the aversion a while ago, the I am bad thoughts, all of that.
Yeah. Well, once I describe the inquiries, it'll become clear about how we deal with it. Because the inquiries are a real structured way of discerning between craving thoughts and aversion thoughts. So that you really get a clear picture of how they feel different, but they come together.
Okay, good. You want to wait?
No. I said we might want to wait for that.
Yeah, yeah. I think Jacqueline can wait because we will get into the inquiries. And we have one more question. Okay, this question isn't as important, I don't think, but we will take this question, two more questions quick, and then we'll get to the inquiries. Igor wants to know what TV show were you watching? He says he wants to watch that TV show too.
Oh, yeah. I was watching, Grey's Anatomy where there was a lady who was having a baby at the same time her husband was dying. So she was losing her husband and the baby was coming in, and there was something that I saw about the impermanence of life. Yeah. Right there, that there's nothing to hold on to, and you know that everything passes, and it, I guess there was a letting go and seeing that, but you know that can't be really a formula because you could watch that episode and
but I understand. So that was a good question and a good answer, thank you. And then one more, Sharon wants to know if your center takes insurance, and she does have a child who's addicted, so this may be a very serious question.
Yeah, I mean, because I was thinking that the people in your audience may have a spouse, a loved one, a child who addicted to alcohol. So yes, we take insurance for alcohol and drugs only. We're working on taking insurance for mental health issues, but it's a longer process. But we do take, you just have to call us up. Go on the website, killabycenter.com, fill in the form or call us, and we run the insurance for you and see.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, so now I think it is time. Let's get into these inquiries.
Yeah. Just start from the beginning, or do you have a particular question about it?
No, I have heard you teach them before, so I'm kind of familiar with them, but I think probably some of the people are not. So why don't we just start at the beginning as if, you're talking to people who don't know what the living inquiries are.
Okay. So the living inquiries are a set essentially of three inquiries, although it's an infinite number of inquiries that you can do. But they're kind of built on three basic notions or aspects of our experience. One is just the sense of who we are, our identity. So that's called the unfindable inquiry. We tend to use that mostly when we're questioning false identities, the things that we believe about ourselves or believe that we are, to see that that's not really what we are. So I'll go into the mechanics of it, but just to give an example, if I have a firm belief that I'm a loser, that's going to bring about suffering. So the unfindable inquiry is a way to question and see that that's not what you are, to literally see through it, like you see through a mirage. And then the anxiety inquiry and the compulsion inquiry work on the level of desire and fear. So compulsion deals with desire, addictive desire. So anything that you're compelled to do, eat chocolate, drink alcohol, be right, or whatever, it allows you to examine that compulsion until it sort of just falls apart, until you see through it in the way, again, that you would see through a mirage. And then the anxiety inquiry helps you to see through the fear-based sense of a threat in your life, which creates anxiety and fear. So anywhere where you perceive a threat, in any way, shape, or form, it shows you the illusory nature of that threat so that you see through it. But it does that by not trying to go around anything, but by literally being with everything as it arises one at a time and examining those things. That's just the overview of it.
All right.
You want me to go in deeper with it?
Well,
or?
Just a little, let's call them examples. Because I think that it's totally okay if we talk enough so that if people feel that they want more, that then they go and seek out more, on your website and et cetera. But I would like to give them an idea so that they have a good idea of what we're talking about. So let's start with that idea, I'm a loser. I call it I'm the scum of the earth idea. I think it's actually quite common. So let's start there.
Yeah. So first of all, you have to name it, and we already have. So let's assume that I am carrying around the name that I'm a loser. If you don't name it first, you don't have a target. You don't have anything to look for. But so you name who you think you are in any given situation. And if I think I'm a loser, what I want to ask myself is, how do I know that? I know that through words, pictures, feelings, and sensations. So, for example, if I didn't have any of those words, pictures, feelings, and sensations right now, if they were all just wiped away, I would not be able to know myself as a loser. It would be empty. It would be not here. But when the words, pictures, feelings, and sensations arise, that's how I know myself as a loser. So I go through that, and I look for the loser. So let's say a picture comes up from being in 12th grade and being made fun of. That picture comes up, and I ask, is that picture me, the loser? But I don't answer it with the intellect. I come down, and I see if there's a feeling or a sensation velcroed or stuck to that picture. And if there is, I say yes. And I let the picture be. So it's a lot about letting things be as they are, not trying to push the picture away or get rid of it or anything. It's just letting it be there in awareness until it kind of naturally fades away. And as it does, coming down into that feeling that was stuck to it and exploring curiously that feeling without that picture on it. And as I sit with it quietly, I might ask, is that feeling by itself the loser, or is the loser inside the feeling? And there's yeses and nos, they're all both equally fine. But if I'm sitting with a feeling and there aren't any thoughts on the feeling, likely the answer is no. It's a feeling, it's not a loser. You know, it doesn't have any thoughts on
right.
it. But if I get a yes, that generally means that the mind, the thoughts are kind of embedded, there's more thoughts embedded with it. So then I pull out those thoughts. I might say, I might get a set of words that say, but I know it's true. The mind says, I know it's true that I'm a loser. And then you examine those words, not with the intellect, but from awareness. You just look at the words spelled out, or you hear them, and you let them be, not trying to, you know, push them away or get rid of them. Just let them be. And then you ask, are the words themselves me, the loser? And again, you're answering from the body. So if there's a new feeling or sensation connected to that, you would say yes. And then slowly you would go to that feeling or sensation and explore that by itself without those words on it. So you're peeling things off of things. And eventually you get to a place where you can't find it. It sometimes takes
yeah.
a while, because you have to go through memories. You have to go through assumptions, ideas, all in the form of words and pictures. And you have to sit with many feelings. But at the end, you realize that the loser is not findable. It's not here, because you've looked everywhere and nothing is it. And you've looked at every feeling, every thought that it could be. You've looked in your general awareness in the present moment. Like, you can look on the wall, you can look on your leg, you can look, feel inside your hand, feel inside your chest. You diligently look everywhere, and you've discovered that it's not there. It's not findable. It's just something that you thought was here.
Something you made up.
Something you made up, yeah. And then so you can do that on any particular sticky identity. You can also use the unfindable on anything. We use it on things like cancer. You know, people who are diagnosed with cancer, that the way that the mind experiences that is often through suffering. It's a medical diagnosis that has, there's a reason for the diagnosis so that you can be treated for it. But the way that the mind hears it is just this death sentence or suffering causing thing. And if you go look for cancer in the thoughts and the feelings and the sensations, you can't find it. And that helps you withdraw from the suffering from it. But you can use it on anything, like, I'm having a bad day. Where's the bad day? Is it the words bad day? Is it the feeling by itself connected to that? Is it these other words or that picture? And essentially you're seeing the emptiness of these things that you believe, the illusory nature of them, which just takes the load off, essentially, of stuff that you're carrying around. So that's the unfindable inquiry, and that's the basis of the whole work, because all of the inquiries are essentially unfindable inquiries. But we develop two strands on each side of that to deal with compulsion and anxiety, which are a big part of everybody's experience, desire and fear, where you're constantly feeling compelled to do something, or to take something, to ingest something, to, you know, or you're recoiling away from perceived threats. In terms of anxiety and fear, you're operating between those two things all the time, which can really create suffering when you're not able to examine those things. So, I can explain those two, but they work the same way.
Well, let's see what's happening in the room. Where are you located? Are you in California?
Yeah, this is Palm Springs, California.
Yeah, he's located in Palm Springs. Well, there's a good reason to go to the center right there. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's just work with a compulsion. Do you guys have a compulsion you want? Okay. Yeah, she's saying, please explain. Jacqueline, do you have a compulsion that you want him to work with specifically? Because she was the one that was asking about aversion a while ago. Okay, smoking pot and drinking.
How would you deal with that, in other words?
Yeah, with the compulsion, maybe with the compulsion inquiry?
Yeah. And by the way, we're doing a lot of other things along with the inquiries that kind of help them with tapping, some EMDR. So I can add a few things in those in there to help it, to make it happen quicker for people. I'll show those at the end. But let's just say your addiction is to beer or maybe wine, and every day you find yourself drinking 4 or 5 glasses of wine. The first thing I would say to people is find a way just to stop drinking, including if you have to go to detox, because it's very challenging to do this work in the midst of an addiction. Here's the reason I say that. Imagine someone coming to my center and saying, I'm addicted to heroin. I want to come and do your inquiries, but at night I'm going to shoot heroin.
Yeah.
Or, see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or during a break, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to stick a needle in my arm. Then we're going to come back in and we're going to do inquiry. No, that's not going to happen, because I'm not going to play tug of war with the powerful addiction that you keep. So, and you don't want to either. So if you're really...
So let me ask you a question then, because I don't know what's happening in the mind of Jacqueline or anyone else, but let me just ask you a question. So you just talked about heroin, which, you know, many people think of as hard drugs, right? But you know, I think what Jacqueline is talking about is, again, after the full day, you know, just like, you know, I might sit down and watch TV and have chocolate, she gets in the hot tub with a joint and a beer. So is that is this something she has to give up before she practices the inquiries? What would you say?
You don't have to give it up, but it's challenging to continue to ingest something while trying to inquire on it. It's like a tug of war.
Okay.
So it's like you're singing through cravings, and you're undoing the craving, but then you just go ahead and drink anyway, which creates the more cravings and more withdrawal. There's the withdrawal cycle you have to contend with substances, which is a physical thing. So when you drink wine, your body's in a physical withdrawal the next day, and it physically craves that. So you want to, if you can get out of the craving and withdrawal cycle by stopping it, going to a doctor and getting on a detox medication, and then dealing with the cravings after you've gotten clean, it's just a cleaner way, so to speak, to deal with it. But you can do it. It's just challenging because you're playing tug of war. But yet you can do it. So when you come home at night, you can begin looking at the thoughts that come up around drinking wine. So let's say you walk in the front door and your mind produces what we call a ghost image of the bottle in the refrigerator or in the cabinet. And so along with that picture, there's going to be some sensation in the body that's Velcroed to that. With the inquiries, we're trying to undo the Velcro, because as long as the Velcro is there, the compulsion is there. So you might look at the bottle of wine from awareness, not in the cabinet, but in your mind, and you would ask, is there a command on that picture to drink wine? And you don't answer it with your intellect, you feel into the body. And if that physical craving is there or some sensation is there, you say yes. And then you let that picture just be there, quietly resting with it. And then you move your attention down into the sensation and get very quiet with it, resting with it, allowing it to be there for as long as it needs to be there, and asking, is the command to drink wine inside the sensation, or is the sensation a command? And again, you're going to get a yes if the mind is producing more thoughts on top of it. So it might say, but I can't live without that. That's the thought that comes up in the form of words. So you would pull those words up and see if there's a command literally on the letters. And again, you're not asking, although, you know, you can actually see that there's no command on the letters. You can intellectually see it. The question is there a feeling or sensation connected with it? Because you have to come into the body with this work. So after you say yes or no to whether there's a command there, you come in to feel that sensation, always without the words on it or without the picture. And you keep doing that until the Velcro between the thoughts of wanting to drink wine and the feeling of wanting to drink wine are disconnected from one another, so that they literally just un-Velcro like that. And you keep looking until the craving just keeps going down and down until you realize, in this moment, I don't really want one. And then it's like you have a choice. And then you might go sit quietly somewhere or go speak to somebody or have a friend over or watch TV or, but you feel like you have a choice there. As long as the Velcro is really strong, it doesn't feel like a choice. It feels like a compulsion. But can I just say one little trick that we've started to use tapping with that?
Yes.
And this can help people who are trying to get off of drugs and alcohol or something strong without first literally stopping, like I suggested. One thing you can do is when you pull up the image of the wine and you're looking at it and you ask if there's a command, you can just tap with your two fingers by noticing the tapping here and then the side of your eye.
Okay, and since they can't see you, he's tapping like above the nose right there on the, right there between the two eyes. Then he's tapping on the side of his eye, and then what was that, the nose?
So it's the in between the eyes and the forehead, the side of the eye, right under the eye at the top of the bone.
The cheekbone.
And then the collarbone.
And then the collarbone.
And when you're tapping, you want to notice the tapping and then take a deep breath. And then you can come down into the sensation with having, because the tapping allows you to unhook from the image more. So that's a good way of kind of learning how to undo the Velcro. A little easier when you're a beginner. Just
yes.
Once you look at a picture or words and you see, you ask whether there's a command there, tap through those four points, take a deep breath, come into the body, feel that sensation, see whether there's a command in the sensation. If more words come up, pictures, pull those up, ask the question, tap through it again, come back to the body. You can undo Velcro that way. So you're asking the inquiry question, but you're inserting the tapping. And that helps a lot of people who are beginners to this to start being able to do it more easily.
Okay. So, and if you're somebody who's not going to go to detox because you're talking about something that you don't feel is a hard addiction, you know, like you're talking about chocolate, would it maybe be helpful to just get rid of all chocolate or get rid of all marijuana and in your environment so that you would have to physically get in the car and go to the store, or is that not helpful?
I think it's helpful. I didn't always think that until I opened the center, and I started to see how when people would abstain from something, we could finally get to what it's really about, because it's not really about the chocolate. It's not really about the wine. It's often about mother's judgmental tone.
Okay.
Or it's about dad's angry look, or when dad punched me in the face. Or it's about when I was 12 years old and the whole class laughed at me. It's really about that kind of stuff. Or like that I'm a loser. And as long as you keep ingesting this stuff, you're pushing all of that down and keeping it out of your consciousness. So by stopping the stuff, you get to bring it up and deal with the real issue. Because the real issue is not the craving for chocolate. I've never seen that to be really the issue.
And so also then it would be helpful for a person who, let's say somebody's trying to do this on their own, it would be helpful for a person to realize that they may have to go through some tough feelings while they're doing this.
It almost certainly will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Do we have any other questions? Jacqueline is saying this is so helpful. Thank you. Would anybody like to take the mic and talk to Scott? Because you can do that now. You won't be able to do that, you know, in 40 minutes because he'll be gone. And although I'm having fun talking to him, I wouldn't have invited him if I didn't already know this stuff. I've paid attention to Scott. I already knew that he was worth inviting. That's why he's here. But maybe some of you guys have some questions. There are a lot of people here, but nobody is putting up their hand at this point. All right, so I'll tell you what. Let's do something else then. Let's talk about, again, the person that you can talk about the best, I think, is you. So let's talk about an experience that you had of a letting go, where you might be able to really kind of describe it and give somebody an idea of what they might go through if they do this.
Yeah, do you mean a particular addiction or something else?
It could be, it could be an addiction or it could be a false belief. I'm happy with either.
Yeah, there's been plenty of that for me. Let's just start with addiction. So after the drugs and the alcohol kind of left me, I still had a slew of addictions that were still there. And one by one, they started to fall away, but I needed to deal with them one by one. And even though I said, you know, stop doing a certain addiction, I didn't have the wisdom to do that always back then. And that's why I think I struggled so much, because I would see through a particular craving, and then I would just say, screw it. And the next moment, and I would drink the coffee.
Yeah.
When I really didn't even want it, you know. And so if I had made the decision just to eliminate the coffee, I could have really, you know. But so one of my experiences with coffee is waking up every morning, drinking about 2 or 3 cups a day, which is, again, for most people, it's not a huge deal, but it was for me, because it was definitely numbing me out. So I'd wake up in the morning, and I would sit with all of the images coming through of the coffee, and I would inquire into it using the compulsion inquiry and also the anxiety inquiry, because there's a fear that comes up with, or an anxiousness that comes up with addictive cravings, like the fear of what would it be like if I had breakfast without coffee. And that's a real fear for people, to actually live life or have a moment where they normally use something. And so using the anxiety inquiry, the compulsion inquiry, I would just look at image after image, go to feeling after feeling. And then I just noticed that, for example, I wouldn't drink the whole cup. I would drink about half the cup. And then the next day, I would drink just a couple of sips. And the next day, I would get it, but I find myself not drinking it. So it does sometimes work, especially with non-drugs and alcohol, to wean yourself down through the inquiry. But you have to be really, really diligent and ready. And I think that I was for the coffee at that point, because I was really just kind of tired of it. But then, so I went for many months without it, and I started drinking it again one day when I was tired. But again, I just did the same thing of looking at it, and it kind of fell away. I've just had the same experience with sugar. There's a lot of shame and judgment for me around food and sugar. So I used to be the kind of guy that if I did snack at night, there would be this like, why am I doing this again? Like, you know, what's wrong with me? Like, you know, and so I had to deal with a lot of the shame and the judgment around that as it would come up at night, like just feeling the feelings and looking at the image of me eating over and over and seeing the judgment of it. And that's kind of was really helpful for me, because then I just noticed that I would still get up sometimes and do it, but there was just no judgment of it. And when there was just no judgment of it, it was just the simple act of eating peanut butter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, that's bad. It was just eating peanut butter. And then eventually that just kind of quieted down. But I still say that I've seen more success and a cleaner success with people when they would just sort of make a decision to stop something and then deal with it. But I kind of did it the wrong way. I kind of find out the hard way that I didn't do it the best way. But probably the deepest stuff for me has been around the trauma work that I've done for myself and the story about being unlovable. When I was bullied in sixth grade, it was a very, very traumatic experience for me, and I felt like the world was not safe. I felt like I could not trust people, and I became a loner, and an addicted loner after that. And I also buried it for many years. I did not understand how deeply that affected me. But it very, very deeply affected how I relate to everybody. And it wasn't until probably 4 or 5 years ago, even at that long, that I truly started looking at that trauma. So I spent many nights, what I would do is I could feel the trauma held in my body. I could feel for me, it was like a shutting down around expressing who I was. So I could feel it in my throat, like a sadness or a buried anger here. And in my sternum, I felt like just a kind of a holding on. And I didn't know what it was all about. I could just feel it there. So what I would do is I would mine out I would just find out, ask myself, what is this all about? Or what is this connected to? And then I would see the pictures of the bully and the other bully. And I would see the picture of getting hit and being called faggot or whatever. And just one after the other, and sometimes just using inquiry to look at them, and sometimes just tapping in between each picture, and just this flood of pictures and flood of pictures would come up. And I kept doing that night after night. And then I just noticed that that area of the body cleared, because I had mined out so much of that repressed unconscious material of it that it just wasn't. And that just was really big for me to see that, you know, this was after my big awakening experience, to see that I could go so much deeper afterwards. And it's very life-changing in a sense, because I started to see how that changed the way that I relate to people. I mean, if you listen to me now, I don't mind expressing myself.
Right, you can be natural.
Yeah, I can just be myself.
Yes.
For a long time, I was not like that. I was very sort of like, you know, shut down and cautious and don't want to say anything that might make you not like me, you know, because you might hurt me, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so as that got cleared away, you know, it's very, very life-changing, really, in ways that, you know, I don't even think we can truly appreciate it, because, you know, it's like you don't know how something affected you truly until it's gone. You know, and it's hard to go back and say, well, life was felt like this, because the new way is the new normal. It's like, you know, right.
Yeah, I understand that. I have a lot of trouble remembering what it used to be like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just being sort of like, that's what I've just been doing in my own life, is being open to examine the ways in which I'm still operating on certain assumptions and beliefs, and there's more to see. You know, there always is more to see, but it's just part of life now. This exploration is just part of life, and it doesn't mean that I inquire every day. I inquire, or I look when necessary, and when it's not, I don't, and that's how it's happened for me.
So what you're talking about is what I call purification. So the purification is still continuing, but of course it's, like you said, it's not all the time now, right? What about the awakening? Is that still continuing?
I would not say. I said it depends on how you define awakening.
Well, start there. Define awakening for me.
Well, I mean, for me, the awakening for me was the knowing that I am not what I thought I was. I mean, you could say that I am the awareness, or that I am, that the presence is predominant, and that the story of who I am is not predominant anymore. That was like a shift, and sort of once that shift happened, it was kind of always just there. Like, it's still there, the sense that whatever fell away or got seen in a very real way. That has not really changed much. What's happened for me since then is, you could say the embodiment of that, or maybe you call it the purification of that, where it's like it has to come down into the rest of my experience. All the stuff that I did not have the consciousness to see and allow before that shift, now I have that, and it's just a matter of letting all that unfold. But it's not so much like, you know, it doesn't come now with bells and whistles. It's not like, oh, you know, like I'm one with life. Now it's just like noticing that I show up differently.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I notice that I'm not triggered by that, or I notice that I feel more comfortable in this situation, or that I don't feel that constriction right here. Or so it's just not like that initial awakening, really.
All right, I'm looking to see if there's a question. Here's a question. How do you determine whether you're dealing with daily stressors or some kind of trauma?
Oh, very, very good question, because the two can be intertwined, because your daily stresses can be from the fight, flight, freeze response that you've carried over for many years from trauma. So it's not like they're totally distinct. I think one way is that you want to do, you know, there's this talk lately about, well, why do I have to go back into the past, you know, because the past is the past. And I think mainly that they say that because they don't want to go back through kind of a talk therapy type way. But I think it's really important to go and examine with mindfulness or with awareness exactly what has happened to you and how you still hold that in your body. So, because you're not going to know whether there's a distinction between trauma and everyday stresses unless you first see if there is trauma. You know, go back to, like, when your dad was staring you down in the face and he had his fist like this. You know, how do you hold that right now? When you see that, do you feel the fight, flight, freeze response? Do you feel that tightening up inside? If so, there's likely a traumatic thing happening there in your body. There's trauma there. And you might want to go look at that. So that's when you know, that's how you know there's trauma, is by going back to see how you're holding those memories.
Those memories, yes.
And I would say, you know, at the center we do trauma first, so that we can really discern between the difference between trauma and everyday stresses. So we deal with trauma first, and we try as best we can to kind of clear that out of the system as much as we can for several weeks, if not more. And then we find out what's showing up on a daily basis and see that might not be connected to trauma. It may be connected to beliefs that we have about ourselves or just anxiety or something else. But it's certainly, yeah, I think that's the only way that I know is to find out what happened to you and how you still hold it.
Yeah, go ahead and look at the pictures. I have a question. As you were speaking, you know, you said people are like, why do we have to go into the past? The past is the past. But, you know, if you talk to some people who have been on the spiritual path for a while, a non-dual spiritual path, they might say the past does not exist. So it occurred to me that obviously that kind of a intellectual thought could be a block that keeps you from looking. Are there any other intellectual, spiritual thoughts that you're aware of that might really just be big blocks?
That's a wonderful question, but I want to say something about that, what you just said, because in some sense the past doesn't exist. It exists by way of a present experience of thoughts and feelings, you know, about
now,
the past.
Now.
Right. So, you know, well, yeah, we can all agree that the past doesn't exist because we're just here talking in this moment and where is yesterday, right? That's not particularly enlightening to have that thought that the past doesn't exist. But to really see how you're holding on to those words and pictures and feelings from the past as they're coming through here to me is good. But your question was,
Are there intellectual, spiritual teachings that actually get in the way of healing?
Oh, yes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, there are. Because, yeah, oh gosh, that's a whole sad song in and of itself. Yeah, I mean, any of the insights can get in the way when they're overly intellectualized. Anything that you think that if anybody tells me they know what reality is all about, and they, especially if they reduce it all to one little pithy saying, it's almost immediately a red alert for me. Because how can you know really anything? And so if your mind is really trying to hone in on some knowledge or some insight, really grasping and holding on to that, I almost always want to ask deeper questions like, what would you have to feel if you didn't know that?
Hmm.
Like, what would you really have to feel if you couldn't have that thought anymore? That reality is this or that? Or so, yeah, maybe just to sum it up, any of them can be that way. There can be bypassing in any way, even with our methodology, if you don't use it the right way, like, there could be bypassing.
And so let's just say that there's someone listening that, you know, that maybe is bypassing and maybe there's something in them that's trying to point that out. Is there anything that you can say that may help someone become more aware of the fact that they're using spirituality to bypass or to not heal?
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to how you hold things. So if you've had experiences or insights and they become concretized into some belief or dogmatic idea or where you're really holding on to it, especially if you're beating people up with it, like if you're insisting that you know what the right answer is and they're wrong, they don't have it right, I would almost always assume that there's something there that hasn't been examined underneath that, because where does that come from? That's not really what the teachings are about. It's about holding on to something or beating people up with or one-upsmanship or so I would say that's one way. It's just spot when that's happening for you, when you feel you're clinging tightly to some ideas or beliefs or ways of thinking about things. And also if you're arguing a lot with other people, that's a good indication, because you know, not that arguing there's anything inherently wrong with it, because sometimes it has to happen. We have to kind of work things out through argument. But if you're doing it a lot, you see that happening a lot, and people are getting frustrated with you, they're trying to tell you that you're stuck. They may not have the words to tell you, but they're all your teachers, and they're trying to tell you that you're stuck somewhere. So if you keep seeing that, is one way. If you're still operating on some of the old, like, here's the one I really want to talk about. I don't know how much your audience is aware of the Enneagram, but I think it's a very, very wise tool. I really do. Because I think what it can show you is the ways in which we survive. It can show you the way in which we survive in the world. And if you've had an awakening experience, but you're still surviving in the old way, so let's say you're a perfectionist, and that's your ego structure, and you have this awakening, and all of a sudden you're still operating on that. Like, you're talking the same talk as a perfectionist, and you're still using the same patterns and surviving in the same way, that's pretty much an indication that I think that the core hasn't been seen through, that you're still operating from that core identity, whatever that is. And the Enneagram is really good about illuminating what those core identities are. For me, it was peacemaker. So after I had my experiences, like I associated non-dual awakening with just being at peace. Well, that was actually very delusional in some sense, because what it was for me was trying to avoid conflict and trying to avoid anger and fear underneath the conflict, which even under that is trying to avoid having to feel the feeling of unlovability when there is conflict. Mm-hmm. And so if you find yourself operating, find out what your Enneagram type is and see the ways, and see if you're still operating in that way in the world, and let that be a cue that you haven't gone as deep as you maybe thought you did.
All right, that's a fun tip. I haven't done the Enneagram in, 25 years. It might be fun to try it again and look and see.
Just to see, because most of these things, I think, are just ways that our mechanism has found to avoid having to feel something.
Yeah.
To simplify it down to that. And so if if you have a sense that you're doing that, you should follow that. If you have a sense that there's something that you're trying not to feel, even if you can't pinpoint it, if you get really honest and you come in and you go, it's time for me to stop this, and I have to finally face that. Sometimes it's just a matter of having a sense that there's something you're not looking at.
Yeah, and I think it's fun. I know not everybody thinks it's fun, but I think it's fun to find new ways to look where you might not have seen yet, and to keep the discovery happening and the letting go or the purification continuing. Because, of course, as you know, with each letting go or seeing through, as you call it, there's, you know, another freedom.
Yep.
So it's fun.
Well, it is for me too. I mean, totally. Yeah, and I think that for a lot of people, it's not because they maybe had a background of seeking, and they might hear you saying, "Well, you mean I have to purify myself forever?" Because they're still hearing it from that.
Yeah.
Well, I got to seek something. But I don't hear you saying that.
Yeah.
I mean, because once the spiritual seeking dies and you start to recognize this is it, you know, whatever this is, we're here. This moment is it. And then the purification happens within this, not really from seeking, but from being open.
Yeah, just from continuing to undress the little blinders, to take off the little blinders, right?
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. I think we have some more questions. Oh, my goodness, we have a few of them. Let's see. You have mentioned several times the word trauma. How do you define trauma?
I think I defined it earlier, but maybe it wasn't obvious that I was defining it. Think of it as like a pivotal event or events in your life that were somewhat emotionally overwhelming, but that you weren't able to process. So, you know, I think of it this way. There's the definition, but now I take it to a practical experience, back to me being bullied. When I was bullied, that was really, really scary. And I was also, on some level, very, very angry, because these were my best friends bullying me. So I was angry.
Mm.
And I was also very, very scared. But never in my childhood did my mom or my dad, by no fault of their own, say, if you're feeling this fear, come down and be with this quietly. Let me sit with you and let you be with this quietly, or inquire into it. You know, none of that happened. So I would just cope like everybody else did, is that I just pushed it down and pushed it out of my experience. But it was still there, and it manifested as addiction and how I related to other people. So trauma, when something overwhelming happens and we emotionally don't process it, we carry its effects often through our lives, and it's affecting how we relate to people and circumstances until it gets cleared away, and then the new normal starts to show up.
The new normal. Yeah. Okay, let's see. What else have we got here? From Tony, your approach seems rather intellectual. How do you deal with today's young people who are caught up in the current heroin epidemic, who don't necessarily have that intellectual maturity?
The work is actually very experiential. So when I'm talking about the work, it sounds intellectual, but the work itself is very in the trench, kind of observing every thought, being with every feeling. It's very, so just so you know that. And so when I do work with kids, once you get to the experience part, they catch on to it oftentimes better than adults, because they don't have a lot of that conditioning, even the intellectual conditioning. So I've seen facilitators work with young kids, and they'll say, can you come down and feel this feeling? And they'll be like, yeah. And then they'll say, can you picture that feeling? And then they'll say, yeah, it's like a dark cloud. Well, can you look at the cloud? Can you be with the cloud? Yeah, and then it falls away. Because you can really relate, because experience is just experience. You can translate that at any age. But when it comes to the treatment center, you have to take each client where they're at, you know. So what I'll do is I'll just break it down to very simple terms if I need to, you know, it just so I can speak to them exactly the way that they need to hear it. And then if they have a little more maturity, I can bring in a little some of these other concepts. But the main thing about the work is that it's just really experiential, actually.
Does everybody come there voluntarily?
No.
No?
There's a few clients who come by way of an intervention or court order.
And how are they to work with? Are they different, or do they end up being the same?
You know, one of our best clients who came in who was completely ready and just had very, very deep openings was someone who came through an intervention, you know. But that's not, there are definitely people who come through an intervention who don't want to be there. But I just wanted to point that out, that one of our most ready clients was.
Good. But it does help if there's some kind of a readiness, even if they're not aware of their readiness when they come.
Yeah. I think it has to be there at some point. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. We have more questions. So this is from Francine. Does the book Rest for Addiction describe this process of inquiry?
Yes. The book is called Natural Rest for Addiction, and there's a whole chapter on the living inquiries.
Okay, good. And you can also find videos on YouTube where he talks about them, and he has these nice little visuals that he uses. So let's see. Sonia says, she doesn't know the ideogram. Do you want to tell her just a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so I might want to spell it first in case you want to Google it. ENNEAGRAM. So if you Google it, you'll probably find some site that explains the 9 types. But I would suggest reading, I always butcher her last name, Sandra Maitre, M-A-I-T-R-E. She has a book called The Spiritual Dimension of the Enneagram, which I recommend. And then Eli Jackson Bear has a good book, because not all of the Enneagram sites go deeply into the core story and the core pain underneath it, but those two do deal with that. So I would suggest using one of those sources.
Okay, yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny because I remember when I don't remember much about the Enneagram because, like I said, it was a very long time ago. I met someone while hiking, a nun, I thought, who said that she helped develop that, but I don't know if my memory is false or not, but that's what I remember is how I got started on it. And I remember that I was a 7, which I think was somebody who just wanted to have fun. And I even noticed a moment ago, I heard myself say, oh, I like looking. I think it's fun. So now I'm going to be a little bit aware of that. It seems like the description said I was the type of person, when something was wrong, I thought, oh, let's all go have ice cream, and that would be the solution.
Yeah. The 7 tends to kind of want to go from one thing to the other. Yeah.
So, but I haven't looked at it in a long time, so my memory is very fuzzy on it. I'm sure looking at it again will be fun. All right, let's see what else we have here. I think that's all the questions. Did I miss any questions? Wait, Jay is saying, so acting upon an addiction is an act of avoidance, something you don't want to feel. And then he asks, is that correct?
Yes. Like it's something, acting on something, ingesting or taking something or doing something as a way to avoid or escape something that you feel. Yeah, that's a good way of defining it.
All right, so we are down into the last 9 minutes. So by now, if there were people here who did not know anything about you, they now have a nice little taste. There may be people here who are interested in learning more. You mentioned that you have, I think you said, 6 books. Which people can find on Amazon.com. We know there's the Killaby Center. Let's talk about because I do have friends who have children who are addicted. And you know, at least one of them is here in the room, maybe more. I haven't looked that closely. But let's talk about, you know, the parent who's very concerned about the addicted child. Is there any way that the Killaby Center can get involved? Maybe there.
Yeah, we have a family program that happens all online. You never have to come to the center. And it's not only open for families who have people in treatment with us, but for families who have people in treatment other places or who have people who aren't even in treatment yet. It's for families. And we do this experiential work with them, and we also educate them about family dynamics and how the different roles in the family reinforce addiction, enabling, rescuing. But all I would say is that, you know, here's the other thing is, so that you all know that this is really experiential work, what I would say is go, if you have some resources, go to livinginquiries.com and work with one of my facilitators. If you have some money to do that, because you'll see that it's really, really experiential work that can be applied to anything. It literally, there's nothing that it can't be applied to, including family, the way that one is kind of addicted to a family member who's addicted or the codependent. You can untangle yourself from that with the Living Inquiries, especially through one-on-one sessions.
Okay, and that was livinginquiry.com. You said if you have some money, so let's talk about that. What kind of money does it take to work with a facilitator?
So, first of all, it's livinginquiries.com.
Livinginquiries.com?
Yeah, livinginquiries.com. Every facilitator is kind of working independently, and so they set their own charge for that, but the range is anywhere from $75 to $125 per session. But if you set, I think some of them have package deals where if you do many sessions, it ends up being less than that. But you would just contact one of those facilitators and find out what they charge. What I suggest is just do one session. If you have $75 or $100, just go do one session. Because then you're going to know whether this is going to resonate with you. And if it does, you're probably going to want to do more. And if it doesn't, you're out $100. But at least you know that it won't work for you.
Okay, good, good. Let's see, are there any other questions? If not, I might let him go 6 minutes early, unless there's something you want to share. Do you do, like, retreats and such? Is there any place like that where people might find you?
I'm doing one check my website, but I'm going to do one this summer in Asheville, North Carolina, and then I'm doing about a week-long retreat in Victoria, British Columbia, in November of this year. But other than that, I'm mainly working at the center every day.
And what happens at the retreats? What are they like?
They're a lot like this, but it's much more experiential. Like these kinds of conversations now are where you're interviewing me and I'm giving you answers and we're talking about the work. With the retreats, it's more experiential. There's this that happens, but there's also then the experiential looking where we give people tools and we go through things together. I guess to say more experiential and more kind of getting into the real meat of.
Yeah. That sounds good. That sounds good. All right. Well, then tell you what, we're finishing 5 minutes early, but, and actually, Scott, if you hang on, I'm going to hang up from them and come back and just chat with you for a minute. But, I do want to thank you formally for coming. It was really, I thought, quite interesting, quite, you know, very nice, worthwhile. And I loved your generosity in answering the questions so fully. Because I know some of these questions you've answered many, many times. And yet you answered them, you know, just as generous as if, you know, as if you hadn't. So thank you very much.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. And so I'm going to hang up, guys. I'll be back in 35 minutes for our nightly contemplation. So I'll see some of you there. Everybody's saying thank you, Scott. Thank you, Scott and Regina. Very helpful. They're sending hearts. So, yeah. And Peggy says gratitude for your purpose. Yeah. So, all right, everyone. I'll see you guys at the top of the hour. Bye-bye.